Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, back after missing this podcast for weeks and weeks and weeks. It's good to be back, joined today by Ian Smith, company's editor. How are you doing, Ian?
Not too bad, John. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. And Megan Boxall, how are you, Megan?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Good, good. So, it's been a busy week to come back to. Top 100 funds, which is always a mammoth effort, a huge feature. We do it every year. Basically, the pick of the best funds in the UK, the best actively managed funds in the UK. That will be discussed in more detail on the Personal Finance podcast, which will be recorded tomorrow. So we're going to concentrate on companies news, and there's lots going on, lots of results. Interesting sector focus this week from you, Megan, on the price comparison websites, which we have discussed on this podcast before. Where do we start? Should we start with the market's newest entrant? Ian, let's talk about VI Mining, which is a really unusual story, going to a somewhat unusual market.
Yes, so Alex Newman, our resources specialist, has written the news spotlight this week on VI Mining, which is joining the NEXT exchange ahead of a planned listing on the main market, perhaps in the second half of 2018.
So this is the kind of sub-AIM type thing. It's a weird little market. It's not controlled by the stock exchange, if I'm right in thinking.
And it's not one that I see readers or listeners to this will likely use a lot. So I think the largest company currently is Arsenal. Football club.
Yes, yes. I'd say there's another company on there which I like a great deal, which is Adnams, which is where I have been in the last few weeks. I've been in Southwold, one of the places I've been. Adnams are listed on the NEX as well. Great little company. So it's a good market. There's some good companies on there.
It's a good market, and I think in this case, management look to be, based on what Alex is saying, using it as a bit of a proving ground where they can get some sentiment from the market ahead of a main market IPO in the second half of next year. So yeah, VI Mining, very interesting company.
VI, is that what it stands for? Very interesting.
Yeah. Maybe. No. But it is very intriguing. Very intriguing. I'll just keep upping it. It focuses on Peru. It's a gold miner, but it has a slightly different model. So in Peru, they have this artisanal mining market, which might call to mind all kinds of things, but it basically means that they have a lot of individuals that go out and mine a bit. And it's a semi-legal industry that the government has been looking to provide a better infrastructure for, and also to make it legal totally.
Well, this happens in a lot of markets where a lot of countries where you have these kind of very, very big resources out there, resource bases out there. This happens in Africa too. You have this artisanal mining, but this is formalizing it. This is why it's interesting.
And it's also using foreign private capital to increase the productivity of a local industry in a way that arguably they would argue is less exploitative for the workers, or at least some of the economic value remains in the country. And just to bear out that point, currently some of these miners have to travel for hundreds of kilometers to in order to smelt the gold that they've dug out, and this will provide for a lot of those people a closer point, and also those miners, as Alex explains in the piece, might end up sleeping beside their own rock that they've dug out for days on end until their wares are then sold. So this is a way of providing a quicker turnaround, not as far as travel for these miners, so the productivity of those increases. There's also a corporate social responsibility strategy of the company to invest in local services, and they very much seem to be doing this with the blessing of the Peruvian authorities, because of the way that they are kind of increasing this productivity and serving this industry and helping to formalize it. So yeah, it's a really interesting company in terms of how they're trying to address the natural resources on the other side of the world.
Okay, so basically what they're doing is putting an infrastructure in place to help the local mining community, as it were, which is why the title of the piece is the Uber of mining.
Yeah, and what you don't have to worry about, as you might with another kind of miner, is that they have to go there, then they have to find the provable reserves, and then they have to dig it out. In this case, the supply will be coming to them if they just build the infrastructure, because it's dug up by these local workers. So in that way, there's less of that development risk, I suppose, that you would have with a traditional miner. And potentially, I think, which is what Alex touches on, and I touch on a little bit in my taking stock, perhaps there's less political risk as well.
We'll come on to that.
Because of the way that they've sought to structure it. So it's an interesting kind of provision of capital to a developing economy.
Okay, so we'll come on to the political risk. I mean, I just as an aside, I see a parallel in what VI is doing with what some of the palm oil producers do that are listed on the London market, because a lot of those guys will process the artisanal produce that they don't control. All of the guys like New Britain, MP Evans, yeah, they have actually, they offer their infrastructure to the artisanal producers in those countries that are producing palm oil. I see a parallel there, and it works for those guys, and I don't see why it doesn't work here. Let's come on to the political risk, because you've written about that in Taking Stock, and obviously there's a very good example of that political risk on the markets this week in the form of Petra Diamonds.
Yes, which we've covered in the tip update section. Again, Alex has covered that. So Petra have been drawn into some of the political fallout in Tanzania from the government taking a stronger hold of its own natural resources. So in this case, readers will be familiar with Acacia Miner and Shanta Gold, the gold miners in Tanzania, who have come up against the government in a very destructive way for them. A mixture of higher levies and also punitive taxes in Acacia's case. That have, you know, in Acacia's case, again, almost threatened the viability of the company. And that's because the president of Tanzania has taken a much stronger line towards his country's natural resources. He said, you know, that more of that economic value has to remain in the country. And I think that's a really interesting topic at the moment. So to come on to Petra, have they fallen foul of these authorities? Well, an export package of their diamonds has been blocked, and some of their individual...
Confiscated or blocked?
As in, blocked, I think held at the moment. I don't think confiscated has been used the term. So they will obviously still be optimistic about it. And certain key personnel from their Williamson mine have been questioned. So the shares of Petra were hit very heavily straight away, because obviously the market was very live to the kind of actions that are taking place in Tanzania and how it might impact. But then there was some recovery in the shares, and obviously some people realising, well, this is just one of Petra's areas of operations. The company did what looked like quite an interesting kind of communications exercise of trying to put all the documentation out there. They talked about how they value their diamonds. So that might suggest that there's some question mark about the value that's being extracted and how it's being judged. And they were quick to say that it's a proven method that rivals use in terms of how they value and market the diamonds. But it is another example of the political risk of these kind of investments, that you have a president that's come to power and has been very clear, and in this case actually passed legislation saying that there should be state ownership of a certain amount of the mines in the country, that miners should be listed on the Dar es Salaam stock exchange. So this is something I kind of try to pull the topic together a little bit in my Taking Stock and say, is this a wider risk that investors have to be aware of? Are these all one-off cases where, you know, you just can't predict it? Or should you think about the political relationship between the resources company and the government in the target country?
Indeed. I mean, my view would be that whilst they may in each case be one-offs, they are part of a more general trend, and that investors need to pay attention to those sort of risks. We had it in Egypt, Gentamin, exactly the same kind of thing happened, and they actually came out the other side of it quite strongly. So you know, it's not game over for companies that find themselves in this situation, but it is a risk I would suggest investors need to manage.
It's not game over at all. And another company we've written about reasonably recently is Cosmos, which is subject to a very interesting documentary called Big Men, and that details...
That's good. I'm going to have to watch that.
You're going to have to watch that. It's excellent, and it details their experience at the beginning of this decade and a little bit earlier.
Is it on Netflix?
It is on Netflix.
Oh, that's good.
And perhaps other streaming services, I'm not sure. It's focuses on Ghana and the discovery of Ghana's offshore oil resources by Cosmos. So, you know, high risk exploration activity funded by foreign capital, and then a new government comes to power in Ghana and wants to renegotiate the terms of them using that resource.
But this begs an interesting question, which is that actually the exploration of these assets does require a lot of capital, and that it does often require outside parties to provide that capital. Having then invested all that capital, is it right for governments to say, well, it belongs to us, when actually they haven't invested any of the money required to actually make it actually a commercial reality?
I agree. In Ghana's case, and it was private equity at that time, without that tolerance for risk and long-term investment that a private equity investor can provide, would you be able to find such a an oil resource as offshore oil in Ghana? And that's a good question. It's a slightly different thing when you have an operational gold or diamond mine in Tanzania. Maybe the risk reward there is different. Maybe can you bring in the foreign expertise? Can you develop domestic expertise even to exploit that resource? But then crucially, Ghana, they still had a stake and have a stake in those fields. So it's about setting that balance, isn't there? In between the profitability for the foreign investors and something that is politically acceptable to the domestic authorities. And if you care about that country and its economic growth, something that's healthy for the local community.
And arguably, we should care about all countries and their economic development. That is, after all, what you know, often our foreign policy is directed towards. VI is trying to address that in some way.
Yeah,
and it's worth keeping an eye on in that respect alone.
Especially at a time when inequality between the global south in terms of developing countries and the global north in terms of the kind of the G7 and the the more developed economic countries is getting worse, and people are very live to this inequality. So I think, given there's that imbalance there, you would be sensible to expect that some countries and politicians in the global south are going to try and redress that balance somehow. And I think you'll have perhaps more of these people taking more control, especially as they aren't just reliant on the Western economies for funding. In Tanzania's case, they've had heavy investment from China. That's the case in other countries such as Angola and other African countries that are resource rich. And with that kind of Chinese capital coming into the markets too, how reliant will they be on foreign capital from the West? So we can't assume that power balance will always be the same.
It's very interesting. Definitely adds a layer of complexity to investing in certainly small cap resources, in fact, even large cap resources, that investors perhaps haven't been paying as much attention to as they should. So, yeah, definitely one to keep an eye on. Let's stick with the tip updates page, because Apple launched a new phone this week.
Yeah, to much excitement in a big launch event at their brand new headquarters in California.
Yeah, it looks good, doesn't it? It looks amazing.
It does. It looks very good.
We're getting a new office too. I hope it's as good as that.
That would be surprising.
It would be very surprising. The iPhone...
The iPhone 10.
Yeah. Or X. How do you say it in Latin, Ian?
Have
you looked it up yet?
Yeah, I've looked it up. I've spoken to my Latin sources.
And?
10.
Okay, so we've been a long-standing supporter of Apple shares.
Yeah.
We like them. We've liked them for a long, long time. Do we still like them?
Yeah, well, we tipped them again quite recently. And based on this new iPhone, the fact that it's going to be so expensive and it's going to hopefully send the earnings up even more. But also, our tip was sort of on the basis that actually Apple, despite the fact it's the largest company in the world, is very cheap for what you're getting for your money if
always
you take out all the cash. All the cash, which is currently not available to shareholders, but hopefully it will be soon.
They do pay a dividend, though, don't they?
They do. They pay a generous dividend because they just make so much cash from all these products, this amazingly cash generative products. The biggest seller is the iPhone.
What phone have you got?
I've actually got the SE, the iPhone SE.
But you have an iPhone.
I have an iPhone.
I too have an iPhone.
Yeah, but not me.
Do you have an Essex alternative?
Yeah,
no, locally sourced phone, John.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's an Adnams phone. That's Suffolk. I have a Windows phone. My family have iPhones. So this company is amazing. We still think it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's an expensive phone, but people are going to buy it.
Well, I'm sure they will. It is a very expensive phone, $999.
It's not a phone; it's a tool, isn't it? You know, it's not just describing this kind of product as a phone. It doesn't.
I would argue that being able to make your face into a moving pig emoji is not really a tool.
That's what I've always been looking for in my life. I think that's been the missing thing. That's why I'm so dissatisfied all of the time. I've never been able to make my face into an emoji pig.
Well, in November, when the iPhone finally launches, you'll be able to.
That's it, I'm upgrading. Okay, but we're still positive on Apple.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's stick with the other tip up that you've written this week, AstraZeneca.
Yeah.
They had a disappointment a little while back. Well, I was away, I think, in fact.
Yeah, I think it probably was. It was very, very disappointing. So it was around the time of they announced this major trial disappointment alongside their interim results, which were also
this
really
was
bad.
This was a big trial, wasn't it?
The trial that analysts and investors and everybody had set so much, many hopes on.
It was called
Mystic.
Mystic, that's it.
Yeah. And it was, so the initial data that came from that trial was just not what they were expecting, not what AstraZeneca were expecting, not what anyone was expecting. It's a cancer drug and it would have been. It could still be a really, really big thing, a new era of cancer care. The trial is still going on, but analysts have taken all potential out of their forecasts because of the initial readout, mm-hmm. which was so disappointing.
But we've had some good news.
Yeah, so this week, it was over the weekend actually, AstraZeneca presented some results from two of their trials. One of them is actually half of the Mystic trial. It's a drug called Imfinzi, and it's also used within that Mystic trial. So the Mystic trial is two drugs together. This was it on its own, and it reported data which was so much better than anyone expected, which means that now analysts now think it's going to make $2 billion worth of sales annually when it reaches its peak.
What does this drug do? What is this?
It's also a cancer drug. So both of them are lung cancer drugs. It's very confusing. AstraZeneca has a lot of lung cancer drugs.
Think about drugs,
Charles. Yeah. They're different types. So one of them, the one called Tagrisso, is for late-stage lung cancer patients. So when you're really at the final stages and all you want is a few more months of life, that's what Tagrisso is for. And the drug has found that it can extend the time that you are alive without your cancer getting any worse for 11 months.
Okay. That is a pretty astounding.
Yeah, it's amazing. Result. And they were expecting seven months, and it's come back much better than expected. So that's really good news. The other one, Imfinzi, is for people at the earlier stages of lung cancer, which is makes it a really big market because more people are at, like, lung cancer sufferers, they tend to drop off by the time the cancer progresses because either they get better or they die.
And we're getting better now at identifying stuff earlier.
Yeah,
so if you've got
exactly.
an early stage,
so the
stage
early
stage
drug is a massive market. Yeah, so that's really good news for them. The share price is back up to where it was before the Mystic trial failure, or half failure. So yeah, investors seem to like AstraZeneca again.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. AstraZeneca looking good again.
Mm-hmm.
Should we turn to results? It's been a surprisingly busy week for results. I have to say, I generally forget that September is going to be another deluge of results, but we've had 15 pages worth this week.
I think it's partly, and I was reflecting on why that was, and I haven't crunched
the
numbers.
Same last year, we just forget. I think it's like childbirth.
I think
you just
partly
forget how bad it is every year.
Yeah, we definitely forget, but also markets are very buoyant. And at that point where we have this, we try and cover every company above a certain market capitalization, you have more that are falling into that bracket as a result of really buoyant equity markets. So, and also we've had a fair amount of recent companies coming on. So I think it is interesting. It does seem, but like you say, it's also just because we forget how many.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, we sort of have a cutoff, don't we? I mean, we might as well explain this because I do get asked this question. You know,
yeah,
it's nominally 100 million.
Yeah, so I mean, there are exceptions because we look at a number of things like the liquidity in the shares, the ownership of the shares, how likely our readers are to own them. But 100 million pounds in market capitalization, above that, we try and cover every company at their half year and full year results stage. We will also cover smaller companies if they're tips, or perhaps if we've covered them a lot and we don't want to, and we've kind of previously been positive on them or very negative on them, and we need to update it. So there is some latitude. But yeah, broadly in that above £100 million bracket, we try and provide a view on them at least twice a year in addition to all the other stuff we do.
Woe betide me saying that a market crash would make our jobs a little bit easier.
A lot of M&A.
A lot of M&A, yeah. So what have we got this week? Let's start with JD Sports because they were a company that we have pretty much had on a buy since as long as I can remember. I mean, a good decade we've had this company on a buy most of the time.
Yeah.
And it's proven to be good. But they had a bit of a nightmare earlier this year.
Yeah, it's generally been a very successful company. It continues to do very well because everyone wants Athleisure wear. I personally can't.
Athleisure.
Athleisure.
It's Heath Ledger wearing athletics.
Athleisure, a combination of athletics and accounting.
I'm going to say it again. It's a really hard word to say.
Athleisure.
Athleisure.
Yeah.
Athleisure.
Don't worry. It's a made up word anyway.
I know. It's a stupid word.
Right. Anyway. But
it's still popular. Athleisure. Uh-huh. But it's still very popular.
I can't stand it. But lots of people do like to wear their sports clothes all day long. And
my kids are at that age.
Yeah. We've had that conversation.
We have on this podcast. Yeah. No. So, you know, I never understood why there was this sort of sudden skepticism that JD Sports model was continuing to work because I know how much I spend there or how much my kids spend
Scuttle
there or what they ask for their birthday or what vouchers they want. JD Sports roaring back.
Yeah. So the growth rates over the last few years have been phenomenal. But then, a few months ago it was that they were not particularly enthusiastic. The chief financial officer has now since said, with the benefit of hindsight, they were perhaps overly cautious at their AGM.
Were they trying a next? I'm going to give you some sort of gloomy guidance, then we've got to smash it.
Yeah.
But it was more confusing than it was understating or overstating the problems, right? It was just, there was a lot of timing issues. They were saying timing issues make it hard for us to put reliance on our like-for-like sales, which some people took as very negative, but actually it turns out that that mix effect hasn't had as much of an impact.
And the like-for-like sales weren't as good as they have been in the past, but they were still pretty phenomenal considering how much JD Sports has been growing in the last few years. And then they talked briefly about margin pressures as well, but there was absolutely no evidence of these margin pressures in these results. The margins were still great, and so it was very strange. So the shares rebounded, not actually that much. They're still looking quite cheap compared to their historical valuation.
They always have.
They always have.
It's like Apple. They've always been cheap.
But
and
even
people
compared
are nervy
to...
at the moment about the consumer economy and squeezed incomes, right?
That's fair enough. That's absolutely fair enough. But JD Sports is roaring back. Yeah. Next, again, there were questions over Next in the last few months. I wrote an editorial on it after a note which suggested they'd had a Kodak moment.
Yeah.
And that's proven not to be the case at all. They've had some good figures today.
Results today. Well, I mean, the figures, the actual interim figures are not great, but the outlook is amazing. And they suddenly have decided that they're not going to have to raise their prices as much as they had expected they were going to. So all the customers are coming back.
That's really good because they are expensive. So as a shopper, as a shopper, I don't do a lot of shopping. my wife has said to me that she loves the stuff in Next, but it's too expensive. So price rises. Good quality though. Is there such a thing on the high street anymore? I don't know. I would question that. But anyway, the point is that price rises were killing them.
Yeah.
And
they were becoming quite necessary for them to offset the inflated costs, right, with the decline in sterling. So it was very important. And this was part of the worry from January when they had that profit warning, was are they going to be able to get the kind of full price sales that they need to get in order to protect their margins? But actually, it looks like, yet again, things are perhaps better than they looked at the last warning or trading statement.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, Next has always has a reputation for being gloomy and beating it, and you know.
But even in these results, which the share price is up so much today, the outlook statement is
10%, wasn't it? 10 or 11%.
Yeah, it was amazing. But even so, the tone is still really, really like gloomy.
That's just Next.
And you can read our analysis of that on the website because that will be in next week's print issue.
Yes, not in the magazine this week. Morrison's had some figures today as well, which were again very strong. Very much an indication that the recovery there is really gathering speed. I think both Next and Morrison's have said that any of the sterling related price increases that they were having to push through have gone. They're not predicting that we're going to see much more of that.
And in Morrison's, just make the food smaller. That's what you do if you're a food retailer, isn't it? It's shrinkflation.
Well, that's good for everybody.
There you go.
Okay, let's whiz through the results section. I'll tell you what I like this week, which I've written about in my editorial, Frontier. Mm. Maybe we'll miss the eyed for my teenage years. Elite.
Yeah, it's now called Elite Dangerous Horizons.
So this is Frontier Developments, which is a software developer, a games developer, used to develop games for other people, started to develop games off its own book. And this is flying, this game.
Oh, yeah, the share price rise in the last year is something like 600%. It's incredible.
I think it's more than that.
Really?
Yeah, it's insane.
Well, how much was it up on the tip? Anyway, it's a massive rise. And it has, it's crazy how much it's risen. So this time last year, Frontier were in quite a bad place. They'd had to delay the launch of one of their games, Elite Dangerous Horizons. And because they'd had to delay that launch, the share price was down. It was all miserable. Suddenly, they've launched Elite Dangerous. They've launched another game called Planet Coaster. Everything's going amazingly well. They're making the vast majority of their revenue now from their own games rather than from developing games for other people. And they've signed this contract with Universal to develop a game based on the Jurassic World franchise. And then this big Chinese company, Tencent, has taken a big stake in them. They've put a load of money into the business. It's all just going really, really well for them.
So why would you not pile in?
Well, this is the conversation we've already had, but we'll recreate it.
Now we can recreate our conversation for the benefit of our listeners.
I mean, this is, I know I'm telling you, it's your argument, but it is a really interesting point that having had the share price rise so much, people are expecting quite a lot from the company now. And any delay at all which has already seen hurts their share price. And with Jurassic World, it's not going to come onto the market for at least another year. People may sort of start giving up on it. They need something to keep the sales ticking up. And
yeah,
there are going to be delays.
My issue with gaming. I love this. I love the idea of this company. I think they're doing an amazing thing. It's the same guy that runs it who wrote the original software for the BBC Micro back in 1984. I mean, I just love this story. Yeah. I love it. I think this is amazing. But, you know, putting my investment hat on, I think shareholders need to be a bit more circumspect about how they judge the prospects of gaming companies. We have been here before. Mm-hmm. We have seen companies like this who have these amazing franchises which seem like they could, you know, dominate the world of gaming. But delays kill. Delays are a nightmare. Games development is really, really expensive now. So I just looked at that share price, and whilst I really love the story, I looked at the share price and it terrified me.
Yeah, yeah. And Frontier is now having to spend quite a lot on expanding its headcount. They need to employ all these super duper intelligent gaming legends who are going to develop Jurassic World, and it's going to cost them. And that is why the forecasts for next year are really, really not very good. And if people haven't really, people have got used to the fact that Frontier is doing really well, next year when their profit and earnings collapse again because they've had to spend so much on developing the game, people are going to be like, oh god, what's happening?
You're just going to get nervous.
Yeah, indeed.
And that's what actually, that worries me about a lot of these stories where you see these very sharp share price increases. Well, it happened to One Disco as an example, who you've also covered this week. I remember the optimism around that company was huge, and then it had a couple of disappointments. Share price gets hammered. Back on the right trajectory now, but yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't actually me that wrote this, it was Harry.
Oh,
Harry
sorry.
Wrote it. But yeah, it's another...
It's encroaching on your sector, Megan.
I mean, I think with these kind of companies, they have a very clear idea, and investors have a very clear idea of the addressable market, because you can look at how many people played the last similar game or the last exact game in the franchise. So you have this expectation of sales, which is huge, as compared to another kind of disruptive software company where you think, well, it's a good piece of software, but we're not sure how many businesses might kind of buy it, and then they build it up. I wonder how much is being baked into the price of sales in terms of thinking how much they can sell. And like you say, the execution risk must be then so high that they can. I mean, Jurassic World was one of the biggest movies to come out in this decade, right?
I think it was the biggest foreign opening of a Hollywood film ever.
So the expectation is going to be huge about the amount of people playing this game, and any disappointment with it is potentially going to be very.
And then the other thing with that, as we were talking about the other day as well, is how much they're having to pay Universal for it, and where the license extends to. And they do have, the license is global, but how much they're having to pay in different markets to launch this game, and will the sales actually match what they've had to pay for it up front? We don't know.
It's complex.
Yeah.
It's much more complex than the sort of reductive good game share price rise suggests.
Especially with Tencent getting involved.
But as you said to me, Megan, Tencent are taking a lot of stakes with a view that something is going to come good.
Yeah.
And they're kind of hedging their bets a little bit. Again, I mean, I think the point there is don't read too much into a strategic. Like we saw Imagination Technologies, for example, has had a big stake from Apple for many, many years. Yeah. Hasn't really come to a great deal in respect of the development of that business.
No, it's come to nothing.
It's come to nothing. Yeah. Exactly.
It's come to a complete collapse of the share price and Apple withdrawing their business from them.
Indeed. So. I guess I'm just being characteristically pessimistic about things.
But I think we expect no less.
John. I think shareholders have to be aware of the risks that there are in these really fantastic growth stories. Love Frontier, love Elite, love the whole story. Just be careful because that share price has gone mad.
Yeah.
Okay, let's kind of wrap up, heading back to the news. SafeStyle, which we've talked about on this podcast. And if I remember rightly, on the podcast we had them in as a guest.
Yes.
And then they had a profit warning.
Yes.
Very shortly afterwards, and we were kind of saying profit warnings. Maybe we ought to be a little bit careful here. And it's come. In fact, we wrote a feature about this and
it's worse than expected. Yeah, I think the first profit warning said, "Look, we're growing market share," but if I suppose the counter argument, well, if the market is shrinking hugely, then it doesn't really matter if you're growing your share of it. So, and then, but there was still some pretty bad news in the first update, but then the second update, I said that things were even worse than people had expected.
And what's happening? What's happening?
People just aren't buying windows and doors.
Well, yeah, it's really interesting.
Well, I love the way you've boiled that down to something very simple.
From this company. I think from this
well,
exact
often what we don't we fail to do as analysts, investment analysts, is boil it down to the simple fact that people aren't buying as many doors and windows. Love it.
I think it's interesting. There's a few different things going on. Obviously, there's the whole consumer credit angle. They sell some of their windows and doors on credit.
Well, they're quite expensive windows and doors.
They're quite expensive. They're a big ticket item, and the consumer economy, as we've discussed a lot on this podcast, people are a bit nervy about it. So are people making those big ticket purchases at the moment? There's general bearishness around the repair, maintenance and improvement market, and we've seen other retailers and suppliers in that market suffer. And that seems to be related to the stagnation in the housing market at the moment. So that whole, what we've discussed before, the don't move, improve, that doesn't seem to be happening at the moment for these companies. The fact that there hasn't been many transactions in the secondary market might suggest that people will get those windows and doors, but they aren't doing that. So it's bearish on the consumer, but then there are other players in that sector that are providing kind of smaller ticket items and supplies that haven't suffered as much as SafeStyle. So it might be just something about the way they're doing it, the way they're selling it. But yeah, it doesn't. There's definitely a wider sector point as well.
Mm, it's interesting. I need some new windows, but I'm not going to buy them. They're too expensive.
Yeah.
Far too expensive. There are competing demands for my cash. And what I'm instead going to do is get out on the roof with a tube of putty and, and fix the ones that I've got. Until I have spare cash.
Mm. Yeah.
This is spare cash purchase, really, unless your windows are literally disintegrated.
Harriet did speak to people about when she was writing this, and that pretty much is the bottom line. People just aren't willing to pay as much as new windows and doors cost because they're so expensive.
Mm. So they might buy carpets because they've bought a new place, or they want to redo the carpet, not as big a ticket item, but whether they will replace all the windows in their house. Plus you have consumer trend tastes do change, right? You shouldn't assume that people want kind of PVC products.
They could be very good PVC windows now.
No, I agree. But the market might be changing, or maybe the consumer credit. I think there's a couple of different factors. It's hard to tell exactly. But the wider market is shrinking, as shown by the industry data that we've seen this year.
Yeah, I just think it's, I mean, it is a fascinating story in and of itself, but I think it's fascinating how what we've said about it has evolved since they came in, actually. I think there's really something to be gleaned from the process of what they said to us then and what's subsequently transpired.
Yeah, because we listen to that podcast now with hindsight.
Again and again and again to see where we went wrong.
Yeah, and I think we had a comment to that effect on the website, actually. You guys are just reacting to the fact they came in on the podcast and talked about it. But it is quite interesting that they were, if you listen back to it, fairly muted. And when Harriet put to, I think it was the CEO of one of the management team, about the whole kind of don't move, improve trend, he said, well, there is a bit of a lag effect anyway. And it's not quite that kind of mechanistic. So it was muted, I think, in hindsight.
I mean, it's an interesting point about meeting management, which I think you've written about in Taking Stock. And it's certainly something that comes through in the top 100 funds. It's that, access to management is often seen as a fantastic thing that can give you some insight that the rest of the market doesn't have. And I've always had a suspicion, and I think you've voiced this in Taking Stock as well, that actually sometimes you can have an idea that something's not quite right, and management, whose job it is to sell their company, can talk you out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's so much better not to meet management. Make your decision on the company and then meet management. Don't meet them when you're not sure.
Or don't meet them at all.
Don't meet them at all.
And just go off the numbers.
Some people don't meet them at all. That is a strategy that some fund managers, successful fund managers, have chosen to make.
Yeah.
I think it's very sensible because it's so easy for management who know their business inside out to sweet talk you into everything's going well.
And yeah, the lesson for me was Provident Financial this year on that front. I mean, just in terms of it's a management team that were highly rated and made a really good pitch for. And I think we backed, and I could understand how they were changing their business and the way that they were promoting their kind of credit product and doing better by regulators and moving away from the doorstep business. But the way they executed that business transition was so bad that it's really massacred the value of the company. And it makes you think, how much of that is a lesson not to go long a big business transition, as someone said to me about that, but also how much of it is kind of a lesson that once you have the concerns, to not be talked out of them a very convincing management team.
Which I'm sure they have. One famous investor that got obviously caught out by Provident Financial to close on a top 100 funds related note is Neil Woodford.
Yeah.
They got absolutely battered by it. And you can't imagine that he doesn't have access to every management team that he wants to have access to. And he got caught out by it. So yeah, it's an interesting lesson there. We're sticking with Woodford, by the way. He's a good manager.
Yeah. And that's really interesting. I mean, part of with his holdings, he holds so much of a company. Mm. We talk about this. Can he say anything else? You know, I mean, about Provident Finance, there was always going to be a bit of a return in some sentiment. And you think that it's, you know, he's got an interest himself in kind of like promoting what is a big holding for him as well. As we talk about fund managers, right? They want to kind of
talk their own book.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that's understandable. So it's like, you've just got to take that into account. But he has made a very coherent, or his fund has made a very coherent buy argument on Provident and why the market has overreacted. And it is a really interesting take.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, that's been a fantastic discussion that I never expected to have because it wasn't what we planned at the beginning. But there you go. That is the beauty of our podcast. So thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you all for listening. It's good to be back. Plenty more in the magazine. We didn't even get to your sector focus.
No, that was planned, wasn't it?
But we have
people
we
can
have,
read it.
You can read it. As I said, top 100 funds is the big thing this week. Usual comment from Simon from the trader. Lots and lots of results that we haven't talked about, and a little bit in the personal finance and funds section. Of course, stripped back by the effort of top 100 funds that they will no doubt talk about in their podcast tomorrow. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back with everybody next week. Thank you very much.